I'm standing in a really lovely patch of Federal Way, Washington, and I'm surrounded by trees. There's hemlocks and cedars and maples all around me, but I'm actually not in a forest exactly. I am in a museum. This is a sound effect I should mention on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and I'm here with curator Aaron Packard of the Pacific Bonsai Museum. Hey, Aaron.
Hi, Gabriel.
So tell me a little bit about this western hemlock.
Well, as you can see, this is a native plant here in the Northwest. The western hemlock grows pretty much everywhere. And most people think about bonsai as being some sort of naturally dwarfed tree, but they're actually real trees. If we put this in the ground and walked away, it would grow full size. And so this tree was collected here in the area and converted into a bonsai tree.
So how do you make them so tiny?
It's really primarily through pruning, just using scissors to keep the tree compact, trimming back new growth every spring as the buds are opening up like they are right now. And then it's also growing in a container. Bonsai, after all, means a tree in a pot.
How do you see yourself as a bonsai caretaker and curator in terms of your relationship with nature? You know, how much of this is art? How much of this is nature?
Bonsai is really that unique art. There's really nothing else like it in terms of working with the media that's living. Everything that you do in painting or sculpture, it's done. It's finished when you kind of assign your name on that canvas. In bonsai, it is a relationship between the caretaker and the tree, and you're responding to the needs of the tree. You're watching it. You're giving it water when it needs it, food when it needs it, kind of like a child or a pet, something that is dependent upon you for daily care.
And so you're composing this piece according to artistic principles, but it must take many, many years for that to be realized. How do you see that far out?
That is the challenge. So the really talented artists have this sort of ability to imagine what the tree is going to look like next year or 5 years or in 10 years. And the really good artists say, you know, you can imagine what the tree is going to look like in 50 years, even if beyond your life. Ultimately, though, the goal is to make these trees resemble their larger cousins, if you will, that are growing in and around the Great Northwest.
Well, it's that continuum that we're going to be exploring today on Sound Effect, the difference between trees as natural objects on their own terms and trees as objects that we appreciate in human terms, either for their aesthetic purposes or as resources or whatever else. So we'll have stories of trees on Sound Effect from KPLU right after we invite some friends over to go over the week's news, so don't go away. Well, I want to welcome this week's panelists who are going to help us break down the week's news before we get into the rest of our program today. Phyllis Fletcher is managing editor of the Northwest News Network. Erica C. Barnett is a longtime Seattle journalist. She's co-founder and former editor of Publicola. And Barrett Anderson is managing editor of Crosscut. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sound Effect.
Hey,
thanks for having us.
Hello.
In a couple of minutes, we're going to get to our over and underreported stories of the week. But first, as you might have guessed, our top story this week is churn at the top at the Seattle Police Department. We're going to talk a little bit about the implications of that. For starters, Barrett Anderson, maybe you can recap it for us. What happened this week in the senior management at the Seattle Police Department?
Yeah, so I would call it not so much churn as kind of expected turnover in that Police Chief O'Toole, we brought her in from Boston with the expectation that she would be reforming the police department and leading a lot of those reforms. And this week she announced the appointment of her top four vice chiefs or assistant chiefs, as well as a CTO for the city's police department, which is another of the recommendations from the Department of Justice.
So, Erica Barnett, I mean, what's the big deal about hiring outsiders? It seems like a pretty common thing in most organizations.
Well, it is a common thing in most organizations, but you have to look at SPD, which is only, as Barrett mentioned, hired insiders for 35 years at least. I think it's a way of Chief O'Toole saying that she is serious about reform, the reforms that they have to implement because of the consent decree with the Department of Justice. And, you know, and she is kind of saying that she's the CEO. She's going to come in and, you know, she spent a year or so looking at what people were capable of, what problems there still were, where there was stagnation, and then she cleared the deck. And I think that's very different from what happened under McGinn.
And Phyllis Fletcher, what do you think, shakeup or sort of run-of-the-mill turnover?
It sounds more shake-up-y. I'm like, I'm the reorg cynic. I'm doing air quotes around myself. Reorg cynic. And so when I think that Erica and Barrett have been at some of these pressers before, where it's like, we're doing a reorg, and there's this kind of very tame announcement, and then you raise your hand and go, so how are things different? And you get an answer that's a non-answer. And then they ask you later on the radio, how are things going to be different? And you go, I don't think they are. But this one feels different than those.
Yeah, it's certainly disruptive in the sense that it involved that rule change, first time in many decades. And some sort of discomfort with that from the unions, but that seems like it's also kind of ebbing as well. Barrett, you guys had a nice piece this week about some of the detente between top brass at Seattle PD and their police unions, both the Managers Association and the Seattle Police Officers Guild.
Yes. And I mean, I would say it's not so much as yes, the format of the department isn't changing so much, but I think what is really important is that Police Chief O'Toole is being allowed to bring in these people who think differently or who may have different perceptions about how to run a department. And that's really what's changing here. I mean, in addition to adding a CTO to address, I mean, the police department, as the DOJ found.
What's a CTO again?
A chief technology officer.
Got it.
So as the DOJ found, the police department was like way behind in terms of reporting things and being able to take information that was coming in from different sources out in the community, officers on the street, and even know what's going on within the department itself. So it was all almost still on paper, which is pretty, you know, antiquated. So I think it's a much needed improvement, and I'm excited. I'm interested to see what happens with that. The guy that they hired, interestingly enough, to be the CTO is a former Amazon guy. He actually declined the position at first, and then 6 days later changed his mind and called back to accept.
Does anyone know what's supposed to happen to the four demoted assistant chiefs?
They are, they've been demoted. And actually, Barrett should probably answer this one because this was actually laid out very well on Crosscut. As I understand it, they were demoted to captain, but there aren't necessarily any captain positions for them to be demoted to.
The captain positions are all full at the moment, so they're basically trying to figure out what to do with them. I mean, it's kind of a unique situation because these guys were brought in as assistant chiefs permanently under an interim chief. And that kind of puts O'Toole and the department in a strange position. I mean, as the head of SPOG told Crosscut earlier this week, he's like, I don't know. I wouldn't want to be the one who's making that decision about what they do. So, I mean, I think there's some possibilities they might go be assigned to a special project of some kind. But that's really just, in a way, kind of a placeholder for figuring out where they should go.
Well, churn or expected turnover, depending on your point of view, at the Seattle Police Department. That's our top story this week. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer here with Barrett Anderson, Erica C. Barnett, and Phyllis Fletcher. Time now to move into our candidates for overreported story of the week and underreported story of the week. Let's start with overreported. Phyllis Fletcher, what do you got for us?
Allergies. Excuse me.
Take your time, please.
Yes. Allergies. So, with this early spring we're having, an early end to winter, and more pollen coming out earlier, and that is aggravating people's allergies. I don't mind the information and the news stories, except for the fact that I believe I get a psychosomatic reaction whenever this is reported. Like, just thinking about it, my eyes starting to twitch. I can't stand it. I get allergy shots for a reason, and like my symptoms are breaking through. So anything about allergies, like I'm like, la, 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 I don't want to hear it. Those pictures of Scotch broom, I can't deal with it. I'm freaking out. Allergy stories.
Phyllis, are you trying to say that spring allergies are not breaking news?
Not for me. I don't want that information.
Well, Erica Burnett, what's your overreported story of the week?
My overreported story is this notion that, you know, oh my God, districts are totally working as planned because look, we have 39 candidates in the races, and that's more than we've ever had before.
This
blah,
is
blah, blah.
District elections for Seattle City Council.
Yes, sorry. District elections for Seattle City Council. All nine seats are up this year. Seven are going to be districted to at large. And a lot of people have signed up to run. There are nine, I believe, in West Seattle's first district. But if you look at the numbers in terms of, you know, who is actually raising money, the incumbents who have stayed in, so three incumbents have bowed out, So you've got six incumbents who've stayed in, and of those, only one has raised less money than a challenger, and that's Mike O'Brien, who is intending to raise his money at his upcoming kickoff and hasn't really done any fundraising yet. So you're looking at a bunch of very well-funded incumbents who are going to have an advantage, at least in money, over their challengers, just like they do in every single race, or just like they always have. So I don't think that it's the sea change that people are talking about. I think it's a lot of unviable candidates jumping into races because they feel like suddenly they can, but they're not going to really go anywhere. We're going to be left with more of the same to a certain extent.
So district elections overreported, according to Erica C. Barnett. And Barrett Anderson, what's your overreported story?
Yeah, so Hillary Clinton's emails, she was sending professional emails from a personal account. And I agree that that is possibly an extreme data security breach. I think there are definite possibilities for, you know, national security, blowback, all kinds of things from that. But the thing is that Hillary's emails, she was working within the White House, and someone actually approved her ability to do that within the White House. So I think that that's a little, you know, we should really be focusing on the White House security strategies, because that's really the bigger overarching question. And then on the other side of that, I mean, that's really playing out in local politics. So now this week we saw Jay Inslee release a bunch of his emails to King 5. He's saying, here, I'm not like Hillary. I'm going to, you know, I'll send him, putting them all out there. And, you know, predictably, they're like pretty boring planning emails for the most part. So it's like, yeah, I can meet at 3 o'clock. So watching him try and distance himself from Hillary and try and, you know, create this Democratic persona is interesting. And I think it's a signal of what's going on in the larger Democratic Party, which is kind of a splintering. There's like, people are not willing to stand together. They're not willing to say this wasn't necessarily Hillary's fault. It could have been. I don't know all the details, but I think there's a lack of willingness to stand up for each other.
All right. Well, three really great overreported stories. Let's move into underreported stories now. Erica C. Barnett, what is your choice for underreported story?
The payday loan situation in the state legislature. So there's a new bill that would essentially undo a bunch of reforms on short-term payday loans. Currently, you can get a $700 loan, and it costs you $795. And it's a short-term loan for a couple weeks, you know, hence the name payday loan. What they're trying to do is change it to a longer-term loan called an installment loan that you could pay back over months. And, of course, the interest would continue to accrue during those months, so the payday loan industry would make a lot more money. I think that hasn't been reported enough, and the fact that, you know, it's possible that now a $700 loan will cost you nearly $1,700 if you pay it all back on time. So, and a lot of Democrats are supporting this, and I think they need to be called out a little more than they have been.
And, of course, those loans tend to target the least able to pay among all of us. Those are the people who are getting these kind of loans because they don't have access to traditional bank loans, right?
Exactly.
All right. Underreported story. Phyllis Fletcher, what's your choice?
Well, I had an underreported story. It was for like a 24-hour window. And I had to like talk myself down and realize this was part of a cycle. So there was a very alarming kidnapping in the town of Sprague, Washington, that part of the reason it even made it into the news as much as it did was because part of it was captured on video. And the reason it was caught and did not go farther than it did was because of children who chased this guy. And then he was gone. He was just gone. And there's that like kind of 24-hour period where you're like, oh my God, what's happening, what's happening? And that's when I was like, this is my undercovered story of the week, wah. But then it's like, sure enough, when they caught a suspect, hopefully the right person, it was back in the news. And that was, for me, one of those moments of realizing I don't get to know everything. And the police do need to keep certain things not public while they have an active investigation, which they always tell us. And sometimes that's great to know. And sometimes you're like, I don't know if that's really an excuse for not telling me what you're not telling me. But now they have a suspect in custody. It's back in the news.
Thank you, Phyllis. And Barrett Anderson, what's your undercovered story?
Yeah, so I actually tend to think that our national political representatives are undercovered in general in Washington State, particularly in Seattle and at a local level. But this week, one thing that came out on that level was Oregon Senator Ron Wyden was talking to BuzzFeed, did an interview with BuzzFeed, and they asked him if intelligence agencies have domestic surveillance programs that the public is still unaware of. And his response was, yeah, there's plenty of stuff. But he declined to say anything more because he said it's all classified. And I think this is...
Thank you, Ron.
Right. Very helpful. But, I mean, it does tease at, you know, there is so much going on at a national level that affects us here locally around security and domestic surveillance right now. So I think this Wyden comment is really just like a window into this fact that there's a lot more going on that the public at large doesn't know about. I mean, I don't mean to be a fearmonger, but I think it's interesting to know that here's someone who's a senator who's a pretty good record on this kind of stuff, and he's like, yeah, you guys should probably be asking more questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for those underreported and overreported stories of the week. Thanks so much to Erica C. Barnett, who is co-founder and former editor of Publicola, a longtime Seattle journalist. Barrett Anderson is managing editor at crosscut.com, and Phyllis Fletcher is managing editor of the Northwest News Network. Thanks so much for being on Sound Effect, everybody.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we are talking about trees today. And if you live in a city, trees are the best. You know, they give you a break from the concrete jungle, both visually and also they provide shade and they offset carbon. There's tons of benefits. So you gotta love trees, right? Well, you love them until they fall on your house, or on your car, or on your skull. Basically, in cities with so many people and buildings and nature all growing together, somebody's got to manage those trees, both for their own good and for ours. They have to keep them healthy, and they have to keep them off power lines and maybe put them out of their misery before they kill somebody. So this is what arborists do. But these are not elves here, you know. Saws and chippers and dump trucks are part of the equation, too. So this profession, a lot like logging, has long been dominated by men. But that's starting to change. So KPLU environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe went out to West Seattle to meet one of the pioneering women in this field, Kathy Holzer.
There's a bright yellow truck on a street in West Seattle. Nearby is a small group of people in hard hats, some on the ground and some up in trees.
Hi, I didn't bring a helmet. Do you have an extra one?
A family has just moved into a new home, and they're working with Out on a Limb Tree Company, founded by Kathy Holzer. She's the one with the chainsaw about 40 feet above us in a black pine tree. It's a removal, so there'll be more room for children to play on the grass strip between two houses. She's got spikes on her boots and a chainsaw swinging from her hip. Some blocks of wood and pulleys are part of the rigging. It's intricate work as she swings around and cuts from the top down, carefully maneuvering her way to the ground and casting off limbs to the crew below.
I do still like doing removals that are complicated. You have to think about like which piece comes out first and where it's going to land and how much it weighs and where you need to have the reading lines and where the block goes, and all of that complexity is good brain workout, and it requires agility as well.
She's super strong but also light. Arborists, as they're called, are often smaller people with lots of upper body strength. Imagine a rock climber only on trees.
I guess my favorite thing about being an arborist has always been that it used all aspects of my personality. So it's a workout physically. It forces you to come to the present moment, because if you can't be in the present moment and you're aloft, you're going to get hurt eventually. You're not going to be a lifer in the industry. You have to have the ability to show up all the way.
It's dangerous work, has some of the highest injury rates of any profession. But she likes it.
It requires creativity to do a good job. It requires a lot of information about tree biology and the effect of your actions on this particular tree based on age, species, vigor, time of year.
Oh, what did you just do?
It's just smelling a fir stub. The sap is all over it, and it smells really good. That's the visceral part. You gotta love trees to do this job. It's too hard and dangerous and not lucrative enough to do for any other reason.
Kathy just turned 50. She says she's known since she was little that being outdoors makes her happy. She grew up in her parents' apple orchards near Chicago.
And I was a kid that, you know, was always up in a tree and the dog was lying under the tree and they'd know where I was because there was the dog, so I must be in that tree. And I always broke out the dead branches that were in my way because it really seemed intuitively that the tree didn't need them. And so my poor dad would come to cut the grass and there'd be like piles of dead branches under the trees that I'd been climbing. Who's been doing that? And so when they sent me to a pruning class, I was like, well, this is a no-brainer. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. I mean, my last name in German apparently means woodcutter.
But this woodcutter is getting older. She doesn't climb as much as when she started in her 30s.
And there's been quite a bit of wear and tear for me physically. I also really desperately miss it.
She's in the trees 2 days a week now, does bids and runs the office the other two. She has to keep enough work coming in to sustain her company and support her crew.
It's not visceral anymore. It's more kind of strategic in terms of educating people, selling the work that I want to do, that I believe needs to be done.
Climbing trees with sharp saws and harnesses is hard to learn. And for a woman, you have to have a special kind of tough. That's why Kathy says the best way to learn this profession is to compete in the tree climbing circuit. It's put on by the International Society of Arboriculture and draws tree climbers from all over the world.
And in 2000, the chapter approached me and they said, hey, you gotta compete. And I said, what, are you kidding me? I just started a business. I don't have time to go to the bathroom. I can't do this. And then I think it was 2001 that the competition was actually at Volunteer Park in Seattle. And I went and watched and I saw two women who are now friends of mine from Australia and Toronto duking it out for the world title. And I watched and I thought, I can do that. And the next thought was, well, I should do that because there need to be women in this industry more visible. It needs to be demonstrated that women can be fearless and strong and agile.
Now she's handing off to the next generation. 25-year-old Alex Ayers is an apprentice who's been with Kathy for 2 years and sports a mohawk. Alex recently tattooed her knuckles with the letters that spell out tree life. She's using her lunch hour to study and get ready for a big exam because now she's about to get certified.
So next month I can go up to Canada. Actually, I'm going to go to BC and take the written arborist certification exam and become certified. Be a professional.
Lunch is over and it's time to get back to the trees. Kathy picks up her climbing saddle and gets ready to finish taking down that pine.
Kathy Holzer is an arborist and a tree climbing champ. She talked with KPLU's environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're talking this week about trees and forests. And I'm here in Vancouver, British Columbia, with Professor Suzanne Simard, who's a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. What's the name of this forest we're in?
This is called Pacific Spirit Park. It's adjacent to the University of British Columbia.
So to me, I see, you know, tree here, tree there, individuals. What can't I see that's below the surface?
Well, all of these trees, in fact, all of the trees in the Pacific Northwest form what's called mycorrhizal fungi. And these fungi are below ground and they trade with the tree nutrients that they gather from the soil for carbon from the trees. The cool thing about the fungi is that they can actually link the trees together below ground. So even though what you're seeing above ground look like individual trees, they're actually connected together below ground. They also trade with each other and use the fungus as a conduit or as a pipeline between them.
So aren't these trees all eager to grab up as many of those nutrients as they can and as much sunlight as they can? Why would they give some away?
Yeah, I mean, they are competing with each other. There's no doubt about that. But they are also cooperating with each other. And what we're coming to the conclusion in our work is that trees actually like to grow in communities. They don't want to grow by themselves necessarily.
Okay, so looking at this cedar, draw me a map of where the fungal network goes from here.
Okay, so those roots can grow out, you know, a long ways, like 50 feet really. And then the fungus itself then grows very fine mycelium.
Are these like threads, would you call them?
Yeah, like threads. Like very fine, lacy threads.
And they get all integrated into the roots and just sort of pick up where the roots leave off?
Yeah, basically they're an extension of the root system.
Is there any way to see it, or is it microscopic?
When you peel back the forest floor, if you just dig down and you pull back the litter layer, you can see these networks really, really easily.
Is it worth digging here?
We could try. Okay, so here's some. See this?
Oh, that didn't take long.
So there's some white fungi. I'm just digging down into this fermentation layer, and you can see a lot of fungal hyphae in here. So in this forest here we're looking, there's a whole bunch of cedar trees. So they would all be connected together below ground.
How far does it go?
Well, probably like the entire forest would be connected together. The big old trees tend to be the hub trees, and the smaller ones link into these big old hub trees.
So if I were to come and chop this tree down, would that cedar way over there care?
They would be affected. So we know that the trees, when they're connected together, that they communicate with each other. The communication system would be cut off, of course, because the one that you cut down is now dead and its mycorrhizal network would die. And so any benefits that's accruing from that communication system or that network would be gone.
So I'm trying to wrap my brain around what you just said, basically that trees communicate with each other. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is quite controversial, right? So some people will say that this isn't communication, but I think it is. So a communication happens when you have a sender and a receiver, and they modify their behavior depending on what messages are sent back and forth. Now, some people will say, well, there's got to be intent involved in communication, and trees don't have intent. But I have moved my head beyond that. We don't know if there's intent, but we know there's communication going on, and we know it adjusts the behavior of those plants. So what is the communication? We're trying to figure out the language of that communication in our lab right now. Lately, we've been started looking at defense signaling that happens from tree to tree. So if one tree gets injured by wind or an insect or a disease, it gets attacked by one of those things, it will send signals through its mycorrhizal networks to its neighbors and warn them that there's danger in the neighborhood and that they better increase their defense for what's coming along.
It's tempting then to think of this as an internet, right? I mean, it is an interlinked network. Is that an okay metaphor?
Yeah, it is. I mean, an internet is a big web of communication. It's in cyberspace, but we are networking with each other. If you think of Facebook, for example, there's hubs of people that have got a lot of activity on their Facebook page. And then others that link into them, like the ones that are sort of the leaders of the group. And that network would end up looking a lot like the network that's below ground in forests.
So is this all over the place? It's not just forests?
Yeah. And almost every system that people have looked in, natural systems, have shown that these mycorrhizal networks are ubiquitous. They're everywhere.
So why didn't I learn about this in fourth grade? I don't remember here learning a thing about mycorrhizal networks or about fungus linking plants to one another. I learned about plants and roots and dirt and sunshine.
Yeah, well, it's pretty new information. I think that we are changing how we've looked at plants because of this. But you're right. Like it wasn't until about the 1980s that people started cluing in that maybe these fungi could link plants below ground.
So this is starting to sound like a very different kind of way of thinking about ecology and the competition for resources and survival of the fittest. I mean, I kind of grew up thinking that they are, you know, it's pretty dog eat dog. It's the may the strongest win and everybody else can go die. How different, I mean, am I reading that right? Is this a very different, more cooperative kind of a way of thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we did all, we have a neo-Darwinian view of science, right? Which means that we believe in selection via survival of the fittest, or there's lots of evidence for that. What we're looking at here, it's a community ecology phenomenon, and competition is important, we're finding, but also is cooperation.
Are some trees more generous than others?
Oh, yes, for sure. So we've looked at the role of big trees versus small trees, and whether a big tree will donate to a small tree, or if the small tree will donate some back to the big tree. And we found that generally that the one that's rich, that rich neighbor, will give to its poor neighbor.
This is sounding very socialist.
It is.
forest ecology and forestry has been a male-dominated field, like a lot of natural sciences, for a long, long time. And the paradigm was competition, was survival of the fittest. So is it an accident that so many of the insights about the cooperation of forests came from female researchers like yourself?
I don't think it's an accident, but I think that men have been involved in this concept all along as well. They just didn't know that they were looking at it. So there is a kind of a bias towards competition in the male world. And then females, you know, we see it in our societies, tend to be more cooperative because they are looking after children and looking, you know, they're the caregivers of society. So it's a more natural thing for us to look at. We understand it to our very core. And so, of course, you're going to go look at things you understand. And it was easy for me to see these links. But I'm going to back up a little bit and just say that, you know, the pioneers of figuring out that networks actually existed in plant communities were males, right? They were the ones who figured out that plants could be linked below ground. And so it really has been a cooperative event or evolution of ideas between men and women. And we've each contributed our share to the conversation.
So when you come out into a forest like this, do you have like different goggles than a lay person? Do you have X-ray vision that sees the connections in a way that I might not, or at least I might not have an hour ago?
Sure, I do. Because I've been looking at these for years. I mean, I know what to look for. I can imagine, too, based on the careful work that we do that's invisible to everybody else, you know, the molecular biology that we do, digging through the forest floor, finding roots, tracing them. It's only when you really look at stuff like that very close up that you understand it and can visualize it. But if you're just walking through the forest as a layperson, you wouldn't know that to the detail that we as scientists who are actually looking at this every day can understand.
Well, Suzanne Simard teaches forest ecology at the University of British Columbia, and she has done a lot of groundbreaking research on the networks that link the trees in the forest and a lot of other things besides. Thank you so much, Professor Simard.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We're talking trees today. And when you think about the wood that goes into the furniture in your house or your office, it might conjure up things like clear cuts and industrial logging, that sort of thing. Now, imagine sort of the opposite of that, a harvest that is careful and artisanal and urban. That's more the speed of this Seattle-based company called Urban Hardwoods. And what they produce at the end of it all is some pretty extraordinary furniture. So Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad went out to their mill in South Park, and he spoke to their sawyer, one who saws, to find out more.
Peter Peterson has been exposed to various forms of woodworking for as long as he can remember.
My father has been a stringed instrument repairman for, well, most of his life, and through him and his colleagues, I gained a real solid appreciation of using different types of wood for different aspects of a project based on either their strength or their visual appeal.
Peter wanted to work with wood, but not in the same way that his dad did.
Choosing to not work with stringed instruments myself, I moved to Scandinavia and studied wooden boat building there.
And when he returned to the States, via a wooden boat across the Atlantic Ocean, of course, Peter wanted to apply his skills and knowledge of trees and wood in an environmentally friendly way.
I was eager to not damage the environment and to be responsible.
So when Peter started working for Urban Hardwoods about a year ago, he felt like it was a good fit. Peter is a sawyer, which is a fancy way of saying that he saws the wood. As he describes it, companies that turn trees into furniture basically have two options.
We can choose to purchase material that is grown specifically for furniture and let the trees that need to be cut down in the city go to the landfill or into paper pulp. Or we can find a way to cut the trees that must come down anyway for the safety of the people in the city. and use those trees responsibly.
And it's that latter option that Peter Peterson and Urban Hardwoods opts for. They only take trees that are already designated for removal. And there are many reasons these trees could be coming down. One tree might have become a danger to a nearby house or business, or it could be disease, like the logs Peter and I are standing next to that came from an elm tree in Wallingford.
These logs of elm were killed by a bug that is called Dutch elm disease, and the bug lives between the bark and the wood and basically cuts off the tree's blood flow, and so it's left dead standing. And so if a tree like this were standing in the grassy median between a sidewalk and the parking strip on the side of a road, the city would tell the property owner that it's a danger to the community and that it needs to be cut down. And then whatever tree service that the city or the property owner hires may have a connection to us, and we would help them dispose of the tree responsibly by milling it into furniture.
When salvaging wood from urban areas rather than forests, sawing the wood is not as easy as it might sound. And that's in large part because he isn't entirely sure of the condition of the tree until he can get into it. And lots of things can take its toll on a tree, like the effect a particular disease may have had on the wood, or what the treatment of a tree in an urban area had while it was growing. And sometimes it's what's inside of the tree that can make it difficult for Peter to maximize the amount of lumber he can produce for furniture.
I've found tennis shoes and glass bottles and bicycle fenders and chains, insulators from attaching electric wires to trees. And there was a note in my catalog book that when I mill this specific tree to watch out specifically for hypodermic needles. And I took that to mean that one had been found in that tree.
So as trees grow, these items that have been left on or near a tree can end up inside the tree. This is another reason why many manufacturers won't take the risk of using trees from urban areas. And while things like metal detectors can help find out if there's foreign objects inside of the tree before it's cut into, it's possible that Peter won't know something is there until the saw hits it, which can cause damage to the equipment. But the lasting impressions that many of these foreign objects have had on the wood can actually contribute to the aesthetics of the final product.
For example, if you drive a nail into a piece of oak, then by the time the oak tree is felled, there will be a streak of blue-black up and down from the nail in the tree, where the iron from the nail, as it was being rotted and decomposed, the iron is transported through the sap a ways up and down from the nail in the log.
It's not just the man-made elements that can leave these beautiful markings that then show up in the final product. Parts of the tree that were attacked by fungus can leave eye-catching tattoos as well, and any sort of exterior damage that the tree suffered while living can actually contribute to a very uniquely shaped piece of furniture when all is said and done. So I asked Peter to tell what, if anything, he could take away from a tree that was still standing but is likely to come down.
We're at the corner of 68th and 15th Avenue Northeast in sort of the Ravenna neighborhood of Seattle. Standing at the corner of the property of the Roosevelt High School. Considering that it's an urban tree that has some disease and may have nails in it, and definitely has imperfections resulting from the spots where branches have been cut off, I think that the only other place besides a company that specializes in making urban furniture that you could sell this tree would be to a pulp mill.
And these pieces of urban furniture don't come cheap.
And 2 months from now, I'll be putting 2 logs of walnut out of Puyallup, Washington, into the kiln. And the center slabs from those logs will yield tables that cost about $20,000 a piece. And they are about 4 feet wide and 10 feet long.
But to create a piece of furniture from wood like this takes a really long time. In fact, it takes about 3 years for the wood to properly dry before it can even be really crafted into furniture. So for Peter, who has only been with the company for a year, he won't even see a piece of wood that he has cut hit the showroom floor for at least 2 more years. But he's looking forward to it.
I'm pretty excited that about 2 to 2.5 years from now, the first material that I oversaw the milling of will be made into furniture and go into the showroom floor here in Belltown, Seattle. And I'm quite excited to see the furniture made from logs that I remember milling.
Takes place in a cemetery.
Sure, the perils of driving in a cemetery aren't great, but...
Couldn't hurt to... It starts back in December of 2008, when a young woman named Brittany Cox, who lives in Seattle, was driving to SeaTac Airport to pick up a friend. And she got there a little early, and the cell phone waiting lot was full, so she just started to drive around to kill some time. And she wound up taking a little side trip into a nearby cemetery. This cemetery is really close to the airport, so close that you can see the control tower and watch planes take off and land.
Oh, I think that's probably that they're having a service.
Yeah. This particular cemetery, almost all of the gravestones are flush with the ground. They're those kind of plaques that sit on the ground, not the sort of headstones that rise up off the ground.
Yeah,
and so anything that anyone has left by a graveside, you can see from like a mile away. And so she started to notice all of these trees. And I don't mean the big trees that are, you know, growing out of the ground. I mean these little potted Christmas trees that people had left by the graves. There were a lot of them.
At least in my own field of vision, I could see at least 50 trees.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just standing in one place?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were, there are services that you can hire that will place memorials on graves for you if you can't make it out there for your loved ones. So
when you saw those trees, what did you think?
I thought how sad, actually. Not sad, I suppose. I wasn't really thinking about the people that they were there to honor, but more that they were left there because most of them were dead.
What was the next thing you thought of?
I thought, what a pity that no one's here to take them somewhere to plant them. And then, aha, epiphany, I realized that could be me. So.
Is that a thought that you have a lot? I mean, do you rescue stuff?
I suppose I'm somebody that I try to think ethically and responsibly about my actions. And, you know, if I see something suffering, or, you know, I there was a time that I saw a squirrel that ran out into the street and I ran after it to try to stop it from getting hit by a car. And I don't think that's something a lot of people would probably instinctually do. But, you know, I have to go with my gut in those cases. I think it's that I feel compelled to protect life.
Now, Brittany says there was a sign posted clearly that said any decorations that were left behind for more than 5 days would be removed. And it was already 5 days after Christmas, and so she put down the seats in her car, a little Honda Fit, and she crammed her car full of these trees.
I think I took most of the trees I could see and put them in the back of my car. I mean, I can say that when I did go to pick my friend up from the airport, that there was nowhere for her to put her suitcase. Then I took them home. I bought a bunch of plant lights and set them up in my home to try to kind of rehab them a bit.
So you had a studio apartment with a forest of Christmas trees in it and grow lights and stuff?
I did, yeah. The forest is probably one of the most beautiful things that this world has to offer. So just imagine that on a very small scale in a very small, dimly lit apartment. It smelled beautiful. So the thought was to do something nice and take these trees and replant them in honor of the people that they were left there for, so they would go on living.
So that all sounds very noble, right? And she started to think about how many more trees there must be out there. You know, there must be hundreds or thousands of these trees, these abandoned trees in different cemeteries across town. So she convinced a friend to go with her, and they went off looking for more. After the subsequent trips to different cemeteries, about how many trees would you say you had? You started out with 20 from here or more?
Yeah, I'd say it was probably over 200 trees.
So all of this happened about 6 years ago, and Brittany's had a lot of time to think about what she's done since then.
Were there things that I could have done differently, like arrange things with cemeteries to collect those trees with their permission? Yes. Kind of an impulse decision when I started it all, but once I started, I felt a responsibility to the trees.
And did you feel like you were on a mission?
Yeah, I suppose so. It felt like something I needed to do. I needed to save as many trees as I could.
You're like Batman.
Oh, well, I guess so, if you want to say vigilante justice, sure. But I don't know, I suppose it's hard to know whether or not I was actually doing anything specifically wrong. I don't know.
Has your thinking about it changed at all over the years?
You know, not really, if I'm totally honest. I do realize that, like I said, I mean, when I started this, I was 24, and of course, when you're 24, maybe you don't think about things, you know, with the same level of detail as you do when you're 29. Maybe my decisions about how I went about it would be a little different. Maybe I would arrange with the cemetery and make specific plans that couldn't be questioned by other people because I would have the permission of the cemetery to do this. But ultimately, I still feel like what I did was in the best interest of those trees, and really maybe the best interest of those people that put them there for their loved ones. And I'm hesitant to say anything that's too controversial because I mean no disrespect at all. You know, I think
you're not blaming the people who left the trees. Is that what you mean?
No, that's exactly it. I don't blame anybody. Of course not. And I hold no ill will, and none of the actions that I took were meant to be offensive or hurtful to anyone. And in fact, it was really with respect for life that I did that. But of course, anything that just is considered disposable, that's a living thing, I just don't think that's looking at our planet in a whole way, in a responsible way. You know, there's a lot of practices today that are in the name of industry, production, and such that I think really should change if we're going to make a go of it here, the rest of us forever, as we hope to, I'm sure.
So, have you rescued any trees since 2010, 11?
I'm not going to say no.
Have you gone on any sprees in that same vein?
No, I wouldn't say I've gone on any sprees. You know, I think some of the things that happened afterwards in my class specifically, you know, were enough to make me really just think, I guess, that I don't know how much of that controversial attention I want. You know, I had a friend that called me a grave robber, you know, even in jest, but that's still kind of what he thought.
But even with these less than charitable interpretations of her actions, you know, in the years that she's had to think about this, and she's even had occasion to visit the trees that she's planted a few times, she's decided she doesn't regret it.
I felt like, you know, I saw something through, and that, you know, I had done something right by those trees.
What would you hope that the families of, you know, the bereaved people that brought those trees, what would you hope that they would feel if they were to, say, encounter one of those trees growing somewhere?
Well, I guess if they knew it was their tree, I would hope that they would be happy knowing that it was living on, the memory of the person that they lost.
If you had it to do again, would you do it?
Oh, well, yeah. Sure.
Brittany Cox lives in Seattle. We learned about her story from the Judge John Hodgman podcast, which comes from the Maximum Fun Network. I recommend it. Go check it out. Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestead. Reporting today from KPLU's Bellamy Palethorpe, and we had help from KPLU's Justin Steyer. Thanks also to Ranger John Preston, who first turned us on to the work of Suzanne Simard. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can find us on iTunes. You can subscribe to our podcast and write a review and hit us up at soundeffect@kplu.org. Come on back next week when Sound Effect takes flight.
Did he die? Well, he must not have.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.